Welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig.
And this is Tony.
And we're at Yow.
Yow again. Brisbane. Yeah. 2017.
Something like that.
Let's as opposed to 2011.
2018 or whatever.
Yeah, whatever yeah. it be, yeah.
Anyway, great to have here with us David Hussman. How are you doing, Dave?
Great, thanks.
Been a long time coming. I think I've been trying to get you out here for like, you know, 37 years or something. So. How long has this Agile thing been going?
Yeah.
Great to have you in the country. So
thanks. Nice to be here.
Just come straight off stage. We've basically edged you stage left and took you through a bunch of back corridors and dragged you out to do a podcast.
Yeah, well, Cleveland, the sack over there.
Yeah. Well, that's coming. That's the that's the encore. So tell us, Dave, for those who don't know you, what's how'd you get into this whole Agile caper?
You know, it's kind of one of those in the music world they call it a happy accident. I was a tech lead on a team and we were supposed to be following this process, and I read like 1,000 pages of Three Amigos book, and it was like, great stuff in here. I don't know how to explain it to anyone in less than a month. And I read one of Kent Beck's early white papers from Tektronix, and I was like, this is how I used to work, you know, but it's more funny because it has all these Princess Bride-like references in it. And I just thought, they're trying to figure out how to figure out what they don't know. I didn't use that language then. And I didn't tell anyone. We didn't make a big ceremony. I just brought the paper to my team and said, everybody read this. We're going to try this. And it didn't ultimately save us because we had this guy that was trying to come up with the Uber retail data model, and all it did is show us that he kept breaking stuff, you know. But we set up a continuous integration server, and we had this woman writing our use cases. Her son got a perfect score on the SAT. She had like a PhD in nuclear physics. I was like, what are you doing writing retail use cases? And they were great. They were just so huge, we couldn't grok them. And so the smaller work helped us learn faster, and it was fun. I think we went from not knowing to knowing. And then I published a few papers, and boom, I'm Coachy Coacherman. You know, I didn't mean it to happen.
Yeah, it's always like that. I liked how you referenced in there, and you know, I think you said this in the last that you were in, that you're talking about the white book, the XP book, which is my personal favorite.
And
you referenced it to being the white album.
Right? Yeah, yeah. I was sitting in the back going, yes. That was pretty much Craig's in my Bible, really, wasn't it? In
the I wonder if you read it backwards, if there's hidden secrets in it.
Probably says scrum.
Yeah.
Don't be safe.
Yeah,
don't be safe.
It was just so fun, and I always thought of it like, remember Martin Fowler published just before that UML Distilled, and it was like the chapter book for adults pattern. You know, you could just flip over a chapter and say, hey, what's the planning game again?
It's still a book that I still go back to, you know. XP's not dead. It's just really, in my mind, just should be what we're all doing.
Yeah, the white paper, the stuff that goes with, I still give that to development teams. Still.
And they chose really fun language, like the planning game. Mm. Just that metaphor of, like, it's a game. You want to win the game, but the game's uncertain. You know, I didn't use all that language then, but, man, they nailed it.
Yeah, and also really had that, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the practice was built in there. We didn't need Scrum because it had iterations. It had... had all that stuff built in there.
Mm.
Yeah.
It just made sense.
It did. Mm-hmm. Didn't
they? And that was
I sort of felt at one point someone published a book and Scrum and XP merged like that evil satellite in Star Trek, like V'ger, you know, and then suddenly it's like, well, you use points for this and you use hours for this, and I was like, wow, don't conflate a simple thing, and then it all just went to, you know, bad.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I mean, it's something you kind of allude to in your talk, that we kind of went off the rails there somewhere, didn't we, with all these points and it's just
But I looked at, so when I was playing music, it was the end of the 80s, and the big hair metal thing started becoming more and more stupid to the point where I couldn't even be involved in it anymore. But this new
is
thing
that
sprung up. You
couldn't get your hair to grow any longer? Was no. we saw some early photos, man.
Yeah, no. We toured with like a case of Aquanet Superhold, and like in the dressing room for fun, we used to just see what it would stick to the wall. I mean, you could just like, you could glue a mosquito down with that stuff.
Your personal ozone hole. Yeah.
No, but then like grunge came up. And it was interesting. At first, it was Seattle and, like, Minneapolis. But then, like, 3 years later, people were saying, that's not grunge, that's alternative. And I think, like, movement's sort of like, you give it a name and, you know, I don't know if it could have survived.
But the classics still hold out, right?
Yep. Hmm. Zeppelin's different, right? But they're Zeppelin,
still
yeah.
Lives, right?
That's sort of how I feel. I mean, I feel the same way you guys do about XP. It's like, boy, they got so much right that so much that came after it just felt like bad derivatives.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned your rock background, and Tony's an old rocker from way back.
Nice.
Yes, I like the ACD reference. God bless them.
Yeah. It's a funny clip to play. You can see some people in the room are just like, because Problem Child is just so in your face, you know.
What is he doing? Sorry, bass and rhythm. Mm-hmm. So, or anything that has strings that they throw at me.
There you go, yeah.
Nothing, as long as it wasn't drums, right?
Don't you think that one of the things you learn from that is you sit down and write a song, and there's rules and there's patterns, but the first 10 songs you write or 100 songs you write, it's like, here's our Stones rip, here's our Bowie's ripoff, here's our Aerosmith ripoff, and you can write GCD all you want. You're never going to make it a Neil Young song because you're not Neil Young.
That's it.
And I think that same thing pans in this space, but people... Like, people will say, oh, yeah, we're doing this really cool thing. And I'll say, who's your competition? And they have no clue. And I'm like, how do you not know who your competition is? Because I want to rip off David Bowie because, like, dude was a wizard, you know, but I'm never going to write Ziggy Stardust.
You know? Yeah, there's only one time for that sort of thing.
Yeah, right. And but if you look at, like the Replacements from Minneapolis, I mean, they were influenced by all sorts of other people, you know, that whole scene that happened in Minneapolis in the 80s, there was so much influence. That if you knew the past, you could hear it. You know, they're drawing on a set of patterns that are out there. I feel like in software we make stuff up too much. Everybody thinks what they're doing is so unique, you know?
Yeah, we have to restart. Whereas, you know, good music is building on,
right,
the past.
Right.
So what are some of the things that, because both you guys have a music background, I just listen to it and play it. But what things can we learn? This is one of those, I guess, things that when you sort of draw parallels, there are a lot of parallels between software engineering and music production.
You want to go first?
Yeah, well, my that was nice. Thanks.
I could tell.
I think my one from it is really this, right? So you can have a really great individual musician.
Right.
And there have been plenty of those. But the sum of the whole, when it's brought together,
right,
is so powerful and you just can't go past it.
Like if you solo up the parts of a Stones song, it's a bunch of bad playing.
Yeah.
You know, they're just not that good, but they're the Stones, you know, and you have big
put it together and it's dirty, it's ugly, and it's damn great.
I had a lot of metal bands that I produced and it was like, you know what you guys need to do? You need to play less. You're all playing everything and there's no space. I think the really strong parallel is the experience. So you look at the code. There's very few people can look at code and say, that's going to be a good experience. You can look at the code and say, ooh, it looks wrong. It smells, it's got a bad smell. Just the same way, there's very few people can look at written music and kind of say, that's going to be beautiful. In fact, I was going to do this exercise in my session where I put up a sheet music for the Bach cello suites and asked people to say, do you think this is a good song? And people will often say, well, that's too many notes, which is exactly the review that a lot of people sort of got. But even if you know, even if you identify and say, that's the first of the Bach cello suites, you know what it sounds like, you don't know who's playing it. And I think that's the real strong parallel, really ties to this product stuff, is we don't know if our ideas are great until you interact with them. And some of the really great products I've worked on had really crappy code, or at least some really smelly stuff, because it got really popular really fast. I don't think there's any sheet music for AC/DC. Maybe there may be lyrics scribbled down, but it's all iterative, you know?
Yeah. It's play and go.
And I think the other one for me is the minimalization, right? The stripping it back. And you did talk about that in there, which ticked my box, because I just went, yes! Because the reality of it is, other than a few pundits, we won't go there, the wall of sound and so on, but even that strip back in its originality, if you listen, and in code development, simplicity, right? That's why I'm a principle number 10, right? Simplicity, the art of maximizing the amount of work not done is essential. Mm-hmm. And it's the same for music.
And that was always the best principle. Because when you took out the parenthetical interjection, it was like, simplicity is essential. And it was like, so nice. I was mixing this thing once. This really famous producer happened to work in the studio. And he kind of took me under his wings. I'm working on this just crappy mix, dude. I've been working on it for hours. He walks in and just zeroes the desk, which to me wipes out my whole mix. Takes the EQ. It's a parametric EQ, and he puts it up to like +9, and he sweeps through the frequency, and he finds all the ugly sounds, and he turns them down to like -6. Pushes the drums back up in stereo, and all he did was refactor my mix to get rid of everything that was wrong. And he's like, here's what you're left with. Now you can actually do something. And I remember kind of go, I use that all the time in like live mixing. You can't add more good sound if there's ugly sounds. You got to get rid of it. Mm. Why is it though that like... musicians, it takes a lot of time for a musician to be confident to say the right thing to do is to play nothing.
Well, so I think it's the same for developers.
Yeah. Confidence.
Yeah. And I think war wounds.
Yeah.
And that's the truth too. You know, the good developers that I've known over the years and good musicians, they've had the war wounds, the bad reviews,
right,
the bad crowds,
yeah,
right? Or they've had the bad code, the bad results.
And I think the same thing is true in the product space. Like, the product managers that have really shipped stuff, they've shipped something that was crappy, and they got their ass handed to them.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, I'm not doing that again. Oh, I thought it was a really good idea, but it wasn't, because the code is more deterministic. The product space is way more ambiguous.
Yeah, absolutely. You've done lots of really cool things, products and things. So, Cardboard was a tool you were involved in the early days, which is an electronic story mapping one, and lots of other things you've done over your time. There's a couple that sort of stand out to me. And the first one, this is one a lot of people don't know about, but one of the things I really loved that you did over time was the April Fool's Day prank that you ran for a few years, called the Shallot, right?
The Shallot, right? Yeah, 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 yeah. The Onion's little brother.
Yeah. So tell us about it, because I still look back on that and giggle every time.
I don't know. It was just being around people that were irreverent about things that they shouldn't have been reverent about. So I got a little bit miffed when people started thinking they were going to be successful because they went to some certification. That doesn't mean a class is bad, but like in the programming world, I always distrusted people that opened with their certifications, because it was like, I don't really care if you're Microsoft certified, can you do stuff? So one of the articles was certified deity, and it was like going to be a god. It was fun. Every year we would just start kind of collecting the irreverent things, and I just thought it was a gas. So and the Shallot, I love the Onion, right? Yeah. The Onion's an awesome publication.
Was that something you were writing yourself, or were you getting ahead of other contributors? Or?
I started myself, and then I tried to build a community around it, because I thought it could be a really funny, almost monthly thing, but it's hard to be funny every month. Yeah. I heard an article or a radio show once about how the Onion people pick their titles. And so those are the three of us. We each get three titles, and we read them out loud, and your title has to get more than two laughs to go to the next round. But they just read these titles, and the titles weren't like, Three Penguins Trip on the Beach. They weren't, it was just amazingly funny, but they were clever enough. I thought that was a cool riff. So
that's awesome. Yeah, anyway, that's something I always loved. And you're also known, and I mentioned these in my opening, and we've talked about them on other InfoQ, for example, where we've done interview Phil. But tell us about Dude's Law, because that's something I see pop up sometimes just in the weirdest places. How'd that all come about? And I guess for people who are listening and haven't even come across it, what is Dude's Law?
So I went to this really cool conference south of my city. They have these Nobel laureates come in the year 2005, the 100th anniversary of Einstein's publication. They brought in all these genius physicists, and this woman came in. She gave this amazing talk. So the physicist said, how do you know how the universe started? You weren't there. And she started talking through it like a scientist. You run these experiments, you get these results. And she said, I think it's important for us to kind of say, hey, gravity's a theory. I thought, that's a really neat concept. And I was just left a bunch of people that were talking about which process was better. And I had an electronics engineering background, so I was thinking about Ohm's Law. And people don't argue about Ohm's Law. It's a given. So, current is equal to voltage divided by resistance. But when resistance goes down and voltage remains constant, you get what the average person calls a short circuit. So Dude's Law is value equals Y divided by how. Because a lot of people, when they're learning, like, how do you do this? How do you do story points? How do you do this? And the smart people are like, well, that's the trivial part of like playing bass, and then eventually you want to play songs. And I saw that there was like this inverse relationship. It actually came though, because I used to think of funny things to say to my wife at night to see how riled they would get her. And I found out that at that time my oldest daughter's friends were all calling me the Big Lebowski behind my back. So I floated it out as a joke. I'm like, it showed up as a proof on the SAS internal website. Someone's like, what don't you get about funny? But most of the people in the former Eastern Europe call me Chuvak, which means dude in Russian. And it just, every once in a while you stumble on something that's really simple and obvious like that. So it's been really helpful.
Yeah.
All the people that work for me, they open with it in the classes they teach, and it's like, wow.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great way that often when people just aren't, grokking the whole idea of value, they, just to sort of, pull that up, and people tend to get it. So
yeah, with how in the denominator, one of my math buddies looked at me right away and said, well, how can equal zero? And I was like, when how equals zero, you get infinite value, dude. That's the whole point, is like to not be fixated on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, if you think about, like, go back to your question about musicians, like, the Miles Davis of the world. Miles wasn't standing on stage going, well, you know what, that's an F sharp major, so I better play a B flat. Just like Miles, you have to learn it so well that you can forget about it. I feel like there's a similar parallel.
And the other one, which I mentioned in the opening, is Non-Ban, which this is my this is my favorite.
That is just
favorite. I don't even know what to call it. Let's just call it an agile method, I guess, for a better thing.
A goof.
And right at the period of time when it came out, it was just the perfect foil for all the crap that was going on that we're better than.
Yeah. Kanban, Non-Ban. Yeah. It was like I just couldn't help but go there. Yeah.
Yeah. And
that probably comes from being a rock and roller, you know, as a musician. You don't have any money. All you can do is make fun of each other. So it's like two rules in music are never expose your weaknesses versus, and there's nothing funnier than your suffering.
Very true.
Yeah.
Now I'm looking at your shirt. So for the listeners, they can't see it. It says first follow the product, then follow the process. Mm. And with the obligatory lightning bolt in between, of course. So that had to happen.
Yeah.
So do you want to expand on that a bit more for the listeners?
I mean, not to overuse it, but you think about going into the studio. A studio, recording studio, is filled with all sorts of gear, and it's really easy to get lost on one song. And there's certain ways you set up a board. You put a mic out in front of a drum, and you want to get the gain right on the mic, and there's all this technical stuff. But if the drumming sucks, it doesn't matter. I heard Andy Johns say, someone was asking him how he got the great drum sounds in Led Zeppelin. He said, well, if you want to get to a good drum sounds, you start with John Bonham. That's super funny, right? But Andy Johns has this really clever way of miking drums with like four mics, whereas most people use like 15 mics. And I sort of feel like process is meaningful. To have none doesn't seem to work, especially when you have a big product community. But we took a good idea and we turned it into worrying about whether we're grunge or not, whether we're scrum or not. And I sort of feel like boy, Safe has gone so far off the rails with that. You know, it's just, it's so problematic because all
these... You found a new friend.
I found a new friend.
Yeah, they line up these 16 teams and they use this sad train metaphor. It's like, but no one says, like, I'm going to pull stop. There's no way to sort of stop the train. And there's no way to do validation across teams, across times. And it feels like it's really bad mojo to me.
Yeah, and just even the thought that one method spread across every single context and available way an organization is structured is going to be successful is, to me, just preposterous.
Now, it's interesting because I don't know how Don Reinertsen got involved, but they put Don's cost of delay stuff in there, but it sort of feels like it's Bolton on the side, like Duran covering a David Bowie song. There's something good there, but it's not really a great product.
This doesn't smell quite right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like a dog. You look at it like a dog, like, well, that's not right. Yeah.
This album's a dog, but this one's going to be a hit.
Yeah.
I think Dave Snowden calls it the Borg.
Yeah.
Safe as the Borg, because every time he looks at it, it's absorbed something new.
It just feels like it's so constructionist in nature. It's all about getting more stuff done. And there's certainly the process side of, like, if you're trying to deliver something or validate in production across teams, I think you have to synchronize that delivery in some fashion.
Yeah,
which
I agree.
Not true or not new, but it's just that there's no product discovery stuff in that whole space.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other things you were talking about in your talk was, one of the things that really, I guess, has irritated me about Scrum for a long time is you've got this backlog. And how the heck does stuff get in the backlog? And you know, and that is really, you know, we're talking about a T-shirt here, is, you know, following the process.
Right.
And so you were talking about when you're going through your backlog, trying to find the things that you pull in there. And this whole, right, you've got this whole product discovery type process, yeah, that you're talking about. Tell us a little bit about that. You know, if I want to sort of kick off a product, or I want to sort of get started in this, where do I start, and how do I start to get that stuff together?
I think it was about 8 years ago, and Jeff Patton and I were having this discussion. He kept using sort of designer language, and designers kind of tend to talk about problems and solutions, and I didn't like framing things as a problem, because there's sometimes something is an opportunity, and we started hashing through couplets, and we can stumble on this discovery and delivery, and we weren't the first people to call it out. But I started thinking about, if you look at like a burn-up chart, one line represents how much you've got done, the other line represents how much you've discovered, and a lot of people were upset when that top line started going up, and I was like, if you can see it, it's not necessarily bad if you don't know the nature of the discovery. Yeah. And so instead of just doing like grooming backlogs, I started kind of going, here's a really good example. I would be on these XP projects, and some developer would say, well, the stories are really crappy, and that's why we had a bad iteration. I was like, you know what? Next iteration, you're going to help write the stories. And then you pluck these dudes out of the geek trenches, and they'd have to go do this work that's way ambiguous, and they have to go talk to people and do all this stuff. and more of them started saying, whoa, this is really essential stuff. And when you have multiple delivery teams, I think having that idea of a discovery cadence and a delivery cadence where you don't just write all the stories and then sprint, even the design sprint stuff, I think sort of propagates that kind of thinking. What I was trying to do with my bad drawings is kind of say, what if we took any one point in time and said, in a simple example, there's 8 people working on one product. What is the right thing for us to do for the next 2 weeks? Is it to go heads down delivery? Or is the right thing to do to not build anything? And then you start bumping into, well, there's too many potential engineers and they're like, well, I don't know how to do that. Well, you better learn, dude, because that's, I feel like the 21st century is we need product engineers who are software engineers, just like Malcolm Young is a guitar player in AC/DC. You know, it's more than a guitar player. He's in the band of bands, you know. Yeah. I like that idea of continuous product discovery because I don't see that very common.
Yeah, it's an essential. You know, if you think about the companies that we aspire or look to, they're the ones that have kind of found that secret sauce in different ways.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing too because the backlog appearance.
Yeah,
I love that. You know, I continuously say to them, there's no genie moment, right? I don't look like her and I don't have a hair. So it's not going to appear.
Yeah.
Right.
And then, or you look at someone's backlog and it's just filled with like 200 items. You're like, hey, let's delete the last 150. Like, no. I'm like, if they're that amazing, they're going to come back and they've just been laying around there forever.
The story symmetry.
Yeah.
They've just gone there to die.
Yeah. Maybe that metaphor's always been a little bit tough. I will say I'm a little bit nervous because I see this discovery and delivery thing sort of becoming, well, you're on the discovery team and I'm on the delivery team. We can't go back to that because that's going to be like design and engineering. And I'm trying to use this. I didn't use it. I forgot to use it here. Of like one team, two cadences, or one community, two cadences. Because when you get the multiple teams rolling along, you sort of need the people that I think are thinking across teams as well as the people who are trying to be in context two teams engage heavily in that discovery. Then you get like a tech lead on a team saying, well, I don't do any real work anymore. That's usually a good indicator because the person's been pulled out of the programming space because they're trying to say, hey, I get that engineering side. I need to merge it with this UX thing so that when I take our part back to our team in this larger product community, we have context.
So you've got multiple delivery teams, does it make sense that those teams discover together, or is it or in your mind, is it okay that they kind of just go discover when they need to?
That's why, you know, and like I don't know if I'm doing it well with those bad drawings, but that idea of trying to map products to teams I think helps you understand what is the right dimension. The model that I see pretty successful is usually a cross section. So you have some people that inherently sit across those delivery teams. A UX lead, someone on the architecture side, and maybe like an Uber product manager. And then you have someone on each one of those teams that can speak both to product and technology. And you send the Scrum Master home. You know, I'm going to be too mean about it, but like, once the process is sort of known, we don't need someone showing up telling us how to practice. Like,
but who's going to run
how
Jira?
To tune.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Who's going to put the cards on the wall for me?
Yeah, maybe there's a need for that, but like, I think that's the right model. I've used that model a lot at like companies to say, let's get this cross-section of people together for like an hour. And then people can go away and do their own team planning and they can do Scrum or Kanban or Nanban or whatever. And then you get back that cross-section of group together and you say, for all of us trying to make this one impact in this window of time, what are the dependencies and what are the constraints, both from a technology and a product perspective? Because a lot of the dependencies or the constraints are the interaction of the product model across the teams, where you don't have just 15 full stack SWAT teams, SEAL teams everywhere, everybody can do everything. You have some real dependencies.
So is the Scrum product owner model flawed then?
If you look at, like, when Scrum started, do you remember like when it first started? The product owner's job was to not just write all the stories. The product owner's job was to have ideas. And you picked a subset of those ideas and then you built a sprint backlog, which was more like tasks because Scrum didn't have stories at first. I think when there's multiple teams building one product, I think what you should really have is the idea of like 4 product owners, one for each team, doesn't make any sense to me, or a product backlog, because it's arbitrary. It feels like it's made up. I think more importantly is to have someone that's highly available in each one of those teams to be able to give context to people working with one or more people that are looking across the teams, especially from a product perspective.
So okay. So the counter to that is, so I mean, I'm just channeling any person who sat in a class of mine. I pretty much say what you said. Yeah. Is that it's like, well, who's going to sign off the? And by sign off, I mean accept the stories.
Yeah.
Because if you cross all those teams, you can't possibly be signing off or accepting stories. And so, what do we send it out to that to the old UAT team again and make them do all the testing? So if you've got this, because I agree with you, you can't have these.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the biggest problem most organisations fall into, is good product owners are hard to find.
Yeah.
But then who is ultimately, you know, representing the customer in the team?
So if you have four teams and one product and all of them are full stack teams, then I think you can do discrete sign off because each one can do something completely independent. But as soon as there's connective tissues across those groups, I think the discrete story sign off thing is bullshit. It's arbitrary. And in the end, the problem that I see mostly with Scrum is someone signing off, but that's not really the real impact. That's what I was sort of trying to get at. Like, story tests were good because they think they brought more of the user experience to teams, but they were, we got it done, but no one uses it, that impact kind of piece. So the more go faster I think your tech stack is, if you have a lot of discrete, well disconnected things, microservices, then I think it might be easier to learn faster. But that guy that came up at the end that was asking me a question, I work for a company that does security, and we have this great idea, and I'm kind of, how do I tell my customers it's going to be wonderful in 10 years? And I was listening to him kind of going, boy, you're just like feeding me what to do. But he's a security client. His customers don't necessarily value what he's doing. He's probably the one who knows what they need to do, so the onus falls on him to be the one that comes up with the product ideas. And that's why I referenced Elon Musk kind of saying, people that buy our cars don't know what to tell us what they want. You know, Alan Cooper class famously said, you listen to what people say, but you don't just do it. Mm. I think we have to understand that mapping between the products and the teams, and then we have to know, can we do it discrete, or do we need to get a subset of people together to figure out, does it work across them? Because I think that's what goes wrong in SAFe. You've got all these teams doing these separate things, and they finally put it back together. It's just like, you know, 1996 called, and it's not working out again.
That's it.
Yeah,
we can introduce something called continuous integration, and maybe that'll start.
Right, yeah, yeah. Because the code all works.
Well, yeah, that's right. It always works. My code works anyway on my machine.
I don't feel like I think someone needs to write a little bit about that. I don't know. I mean, I feel like this stuff I'm doing, if I loved writing more, I'd try and write it down. Because I don't think there's a lot of people out there writing about cross-team. I've been actually out doing interviews, trying to go into companies that I think are successful and not say, and try to unbiasedly say, can you tell me how you're addressing customer needs that cut across teams, to really figure out how do they do that.
Yeah, and I mean, I, you know, Jeff Patton, friend of all of us here, I remember, you know, someone trying to ask him about, you know, that kind of thing, and how do I tell my story map, and how do I run that across teams, and,
right.
And even, you know, he kind of left kind of, you know, scratching his head and not really being able to, you know, to figure it out, because it's a unique thing as well, that, you know, depending on how your team set up, your products, you know, listed, or the constraints your company's in, it's going to be different regardless of where you are.
Yeah,
it's really tough to go ahead. It gets really tough with physical medium. So, like, one of the things we were going to do in cardboard, one of the people at Verizon came to us and kind of said, look, we're doing these big telecom things, and in order to really give a busy signal, I got to get six teams. You know, I don't know if anyone gets a busy signal anymore. And he was kind of saying, could we take the maps and could we hang teams off them, off discrete stories? Then if you choose a customer journey through there, you might have some segmentation. It's pretty common in story maps to see a segmentation through user experience when you're doing like publishing. It's less obvious in a telecom, because some things are broken down based on the user experience, but other things are broken down just on the complexity. And we started jamming on the idea with them, and I thought how cool it would be if we tagged these things to be able to kind of show a heat map, like show me team two. Why, for all the things that we want to learn in the product space that we think are on this like 3-month horizon, why is team two so lit up? That would have been that will be a really valuable tool someday. It's a way to plan in a different way. So I think that's what I do with a lot of maps, but that's probably why I was passionate about cardboard, is it just gets nutty when you're doing it with index cards and walls, and you got to distribute a team, and I've taken pictures of them. I've done so many crazy stuff with cameras.
Yep, I've done the same thing. Yeah.
But you make the diamonds, and that makes it all.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Turns into a filter.
Even had the iPad, you know, with GoToMeeting on it, and you know, trying to not make the person on the other side
seasick.
Both
cameras on both ends, set up recordings. Yeah. Like one of my friends took a little piece of Apple script. This is a little different solution, but it was a really cool visualization. And he put up a camera on a Kanban board, and he took a snapshot of it, like every 15 minutes. And then he made a stop motion movie that would play over a frequency of time, because they were trying to kind of say, what's our ideal cycle time? Why are things getting stuck? And you guys would have been blown away at the people that walked up and kind of did the same thing with the story map. They're watching the movie happen and just see where the problem was. Yeah. I think we need more clever visualizations, because most of the agile tools are just about scheduling and delivery. They don't help.
There's a great one coming. It came out of New Zealand. I just don't know whatever happened to it, but it was like Google traffic. It would actually, you'd actually flow the board,
cool,
and would tell you where things were chopped up, and you could rewind it and fast forward it. And I can't remember the name of it now.
Didn't Google Wave come out of Australia?
It did.
I used Google Wave for a lot of the night. I did too. So I was like, you and I are the only two people. I used it for these nonprofits, because we would basically take like a customer journey. We didn't call it that, and then we would have all this dialogue around it, and it really helped us kind of evolve that. But Google has messed it up.
We had a whole team using it.
Yeah.
And we used to use it to collaborate, because unfortunately some of the team was offshore.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just instantaneous collaboration. It was brilliant.
What was it called before Google bought it? Was it called Wave?
I only knew it as Google Wave, so I don't know.
Even Wave was a nice metaphor,
yeah,
you know, because it comes and it crashes, and then there's another one that comes in. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, but like lots of things, was before its time, I think. I mean, you know, you're now just starting to see those things pop back into the products now.
Right, people thinking in threads instead of iterations.
Yeah. So one thing that perturbs me a little bit at the moment, I've seen a lot of, there's lots of things perturbing me in software industry.
Hey, hello, we shouldn't go too deep there.
Yeah, we don't want to go too deep.
Yeah.
But with the rise of UX, I call it the rise of UX, because, you know, when I was doing, most of my career has been around internet-based applications like internet banking or all those types of things, right? And when we first started building those things, UX was just part of what we did. Right? Now UX is a separated arena. Yes.
Yeah.
And exactly that. And when you talk about the dependencies, for me, that's causing the problem.
Yeah.
Right? So even the devs that we had working in those days would think about the user design and would be involved in the user design. Now we have these UX designers and UX... Not that I'm dissing them. I think that it's good to have those people.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Yeah. But I think not having that as part of what we do as the full stack team, as you call it, right? And I think it contributes to massive amounts of these problems.
Yeah. Boy, there's so many rifts to go there. So first of all, I think that's the area where XP fell down. The customer metaphor was really strong, but there wasn't a lot of interaction design. The story writing thing was a little bit naive, and certainly the visual design piece wasn't thought about at all. But for me, that's a tell, dude. When there's a UX team, it's like, oof. Now, if on my better days, I'm like, well, let's figure out how we can have those skills grow over here. How do we get some license? So there's a big company in Twin Cities I was working with, and there was this UX team. And I kind of went to the UX lead, and I said, well, we're going to do this guerrilla interaction design stuff. We're going to make these story maps, and we're even going to try and put some sketches about them. And all of us sketched about like I did, so they're boxes and stuff. Could you come and look at those with us? And then she came over, and I think what we need to do is not have more UX people. We need more people with UX skills. And that's, I don't know how we talk about that, but that's the same kind of thing like in the DevOps thing. Boy, that sort of went sideways at a million miles an hour, because it wasn't a culture of bringing ops and dev people together and having ops people learn dev and dev people learn ops. It's just, go hire a DevOps person. It's like, no, that's not what I meant.
Or go buy a DevOps tool. No, sorry.
Yeah.
You're the tool.
The UX one still feels real segmented, though, and I wonder if it's because, you know, think about from a programming perspective. You got to log your 10,000 hours before you can sense code smells. You got to write some crappy code, and you got to feel crappy about it because you did something bad. I had a friend who's an architect, and he could draw these great circles. And I was like, how do you do that? And he goes, well, go up to the board. Just wave your hand until you draw a circle. And I drew a circle. I was like, wow. He goes, okay, now do that 3,000 times. And by the time I had done like 100 circles, my circles are way better. I think that we haven't, most of the programming side of the house hasn't practiced enough of that UX stuff. Mm. But I also feel like the UX side of the house is a little bit scared, and it's really segmented.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm an interaction designer, not a visual designer in Europe, and it's just like, I'm an information architect, and it's like, you keep saying that word, you know?
But you'd argue the same for testing, too, you know, because you got the manual testers and the automated testers, and now you've got this bit security and performance are their own thing, and but it's not enough for us as engineers just to say, well, performance is my problem, I don't understand about it, right? I'm not going to be the guy who's going to go and run that. That test against the Amazon website, because I'm not expert in reading that.
Right.
But I should have some semblance before I do that test to know that I'm pretty sure this thing's going to work out, not leave everything to the last minute. And it's the same with design. I just feel like, we kind of go, well, it's not my problem, I'll let somebody else do it. And that gets us into this big heap of a problem. I want someone to tell me that's the wrong shade of blue.
Which is the easiest problem. Right? Yeah. The shade of blue is not... If someone's better than that, I don't really care if someone's better than that. But I think we got to stop stifling the engineering side of the house from being engaged in understanding interactions. Alan Cooper calls it interaction design. That's the language I was using. Because I think no way everybody shouldn't be aware of that. So I think the engineering side of the house, what we could do if there's like a really strict UX team, is show them that we're trying to understand that. Show them that we're not just write more code people.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so interaction-driven design, another DD for our for our listening.
Yeah.
Starting with interactions.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's like impact-driven, value-driven. All of us are trying to figure that out. Interactions, though, often cut across stories, whereas I think that's where the story model sort of falls apart, where like the customer journey thing is a little bit more how those people think.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things you were talking about in your talk here, and you seem to have a bit of a passion around, is this whole idea of chaos engineering, people, I hope, have seen the Netflix stuff in the past, although it's actually surprised me that asked people to raise their hands in both cities we've been in about who's really done chaos engineering, and the number of hands has been...
Very limited.
Yeah, limited to what I would have expected. Maybe I'm just...
And I asked a simple question, who's using Chaos Monkey? It was more discreet because I was trying to get someone to kind of say, oh yeah, I'm using that.
Yeah. I can understand people why they're not using it, because I can understand that for a lot of people it's you walk up to your engineering manager and go, guess what, I want to pull some cables out in the call center. So, but even the people who just are aware of it is actually low. But I guess we hopefully people know the benefits. But what is it about you that is what to you has really attracted you to this being such a great idea?
I think it feels like it's all the go faster technology side. But for the sake of trying to understand the customer experience, that feels really right to me. When we did Chaos Day Twin Cities, there was a young guy that showed up from a company that just got bought by like CBS Sports or something, local success story. And he was an ops dude who learned Ruby. And so at his company, they do this thing that's pretty common in that space called Game Day. So every Friday, there's a blue team and there's a red team. And the red team tries to break it, the blue team tries to defend against it, which sort of came up in the state's government after 9/11. And that's fun. So, like, I think that model, but that's a lot about resiliency. Whereas I think the Netflix thing goes way beyond that. It's more about, one of my friends is an industrial engineer, and she talks about design of experiment a lot. I think that's what's sort of missing. Well, there's a lot of people that say the word experiment, and I think they mean experience. Like, I had lunch is not an experiment, right?
But when you're...
had it.
But when you're trying to learn in a complex dynamic system, you have to sort of say, which things do I control, which things I can't control. And the industrial engineering world uses that language of, like, she went from an industrial engineer, chemical engineer, to working in Amazon. And you can hear the language. She talks about design of experiment, and she talks about strong signals. So I think Netflix is going beyond just resiliency with chaos engineering. And then the intuitioneering thing is, like, if you have a complex dynamic space, and you're running one experiment, and then you might be able to see cause and effect. But just you start running two experiments in a complex dynamic thing, or N experiments, you might not look for the results of the hypotheses that set up the experiments, and instead say, why is there this weird signal over here? That's why the intuition engineering thing and the chaos engineering feel like tools for the engineering side of the house to figure out what they don't know.
Mm. Yeah, that's what I really liked. You showed that video from, I can't think of his name.
Casey Rosenthal.
Yeah, Rosenthal. And it's just that simple thing of, I'm watching dots flow from, from the internet into each of my AWS servers.
Yeah.
And your first I guess, reaction is so what,
right?
But and, cute, and this is cool, right? Yeah, there's lots of requests, but the fact that the human brain is to go, hang on a second, why is that dot flying backwards? Or why is that dot going wrong way?
You just glance by it, and that's why I think like it's like that concept of automation. I'm going to put up the videos and the presentations from Agile Day Tour, Community Day Twin Cities. So Kent Beck was there. And Kent got up and did this amazing talk. Kent, like Ward, chooses his words very carefully. So he said something like, systems are composed of elements, and sometimes the elements become organized to be meaningful, and other times the elements, and he chose a word that I don't remember, are in disarray. And he was kind of start saying, it's not because you did the wrong thing, it's because the system evolved in that direction. And he was talking about the fact that at Facebook, no one's ever had over a billion users. So Facebook, like Netflix, like Google, has problems, and I feel like the rest of us should look at that and kind of say, why are we not doing some variation of that? We might not have the scale and the dynamic problems of Netflix or Facebook, but big banks in the United States have big systems that are really crappy, and they're not resilient, and all sorts of weird stuff happens. So let's build some visualizations. That's why it excites me so much. The first conference I went to felt like those early XP conferences. Mm. It wasn't judgmental. It wasn't, are you doing it right? It's like, what are you doing? Oh, wow. Well, here's what we're doing. Oh, that's really cool. You did this? Oh, yeah. And you have people starting to share these ideas.
Mm. I think the interesting thing is, though, that for all those things being cool, that base, we go back to our XP thing, is that in the past you were kind of able to almost call it in, right? You could have still been doing a waterfall-y type process, and I could throw an iteration on top of that and stand up and look at it. But in order to get to these new technologies and whatever's coming next, is that you can't phone this in anymore, right? That you have to have that agility mindset.
And that's why
it's almost looping off in my opinion, because we're interested to know, you had Chaos Day sounds really like an awesome little conference. Mm. How many people like in the Twin Cities are actually doing that?
So that's really good. So I brought in Kent from Facebook. I just invited him, and he said, sure, I'd love to come. And I was like, oh my gosh, how cool,
And he doesn't come out for too many conferences.
Right. So the Netflix people were there, and there was this guy from this autonomous driving car thing, and he did this talk that was based on like a Nietzsche quote, but he was kind of saying, look, I don't have a large complex system, but I have this car that has 46 vendors, each which has a proprietary OS and not very common protocol, so if you want to be scared of something, be scared of that. And then I invited groups from the Twin Cities because I wanted to make sure the people in the Twin Cities could say, this is already happening. This is not just a Silicon Valley thing. Mm-hmm. So Thompson, people were there from Thomson Reuters. People were there from this company called Sport Engine. Target is trying some of this stuff. So the people at Sport Engine aren't doing this stuff in production. Thomson Reuters isn't either because they work for a bunch of lawyers. Mm-hmm. And Casey really nicely challenged them, like, so why are you scared to do this in production? We ended up having all these discussions that felt exactly like the early XP discussions. How do you get started? Do you ask people to opt in? Do you start where you can? Do you start where you should? And Nora Jones, who is at Jet, which Walmart bought their cart-based thing, she kind of said, nope, this is different. You got to start where you can, where you should. You got to start where you can, not where you should, because you can't just go taking people's systems offline. I think she's probably going to write something that's really significant about how do you incrementally introduce this stuff, because they're dealing with that at Netflix. They can't, even at Netflix it doesn't just spread wildly, because it's harder than continuous integration. It's more volatile, maybe.
So not only is it perceived to be risky, but it's hard, and those two things going together.
Yeah, having Kent there, though, that
gives him,
it solidified it for me, like, this is an obvious evolution, because he's not just showing up here to be nice to me.
Absolutely. Now, so we talked about the product stuff. So you got a bunch of people together a little while ago and started putting this whole stuff together. And what I really liked, you got these statements, these overstatements that, to me almost, they just make so much sense. And it's a whole bunch of them. And, things like go for impacts over. Impacts over Apple. That kind of stuff. There's a whole movement that you started around this. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's nice that you call it a movement. I don't know, it feels like a website to me right now. It was just, I have all these buddies, people that I've worked with for a while, and I think most of them are people that came out of that XP background, and we got really good at delivering stuff. We felt really confident, which is, I think, like the chaos thing, I guess, to go back. Why it geeks me out is it feels like the obvious evolution of confidence and delivery stuff is like, then let's break stuff, because we know we can put it back out there. but all of us sort of stumble into this product thing to kind of say, whoa, this is a whole different game. This is more non-deterministic. This is more abstract. This is not as obvious. And having that conversation was really fun. It was sitting there. So I think I got really sick after we put out the first version, so we weren't able to finish it. But what I'm looking to do right now with the community is to get people to descriptively say, here's how we're exploring why. Like the impact mapping thing. That seems like a nice idea. I've had mixed luck with it. But in the what space, I see, I mean, Intercom and Mixpanel both use jobs to be done. The jobs to be done thing feels real as I need to, so that, but you can't argue with the Intercom product. So I'm really trying to figure out, like, who's doing what to be successful instead of prescriptively saying, you should do this. Yeah.
So people want to know more about, because you sort of got a bit of a call to action for people to get involved, and to read about a lot of the stuff that you've been thinking here. Where do they find out more about that?
Well, productagility.org, and then I was shamefully, I was embarrassed to put up, like, I'm putting up, like, davidhusman.com. I felt really just like, oh, my God. But I don't really want to sort of reinvent a new brand, you know. I sort of feel like, no, I sold DevJam, so I do contract work for them, but I want to be able to just write whatever I want to write, so I'm just going to start publishing stuff. My goal would be to do something as interesting as Paul Graham, because I think Paul Graham's essays are really meaningful, and I don't know if I have the energy to write a couple hundred page book, but I think I can publish a handful of 10-page essays. I'd like to have, like, I think a really important space is these big IT shops where product, like you and I were talking about, where product is not obvious. How do you help those people think and learn in product and services without forcing them to follow a process?
Yeah. Well, we're getting mobbed by
the party's starting.
That means that drinks are flowing.
It's going to get louder.
Yeah, so we could talk for hours. Go check out the product agility stuff and be part of that community. And just have a read of it. I think all the visualizations, all the things that you've got up there are just... They're just really cool, and
thanks.
We look forward to seeing some of the more of the stuff coming out from you over the coming time. So I guess if people want to know more about us, Tony, where do they find it?
They can find me at tony@theagilerevolution.com.
Yeah, and I'm Craig at theagilerevolution.com, and I guess there's only one thing left to say.
And that would be...
Viva la Revolution!
You're going to sing it when you don't.
No.
Viva!
Yeah.
La Revolution!
But it does sort of remind me of, like, it would be cool to have a shirt with, like, Che Guevara on it, you know, instead of, like, you know, Death to Scrum or something. I don't know.
With a question mark.
Yes, yeah.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah.